We welcome back Jason DeRose. Jason is the Western Bureau Chief for NPR. And I don't know, I've lost count how many times you've talked, but it's wonderful each time you come. Four or five?
Maybe six or seven.
Okay. See, I hope I lost count. I was right on that. So, welcome Jason. He's doing a series on religion and public life. And tonight it's on immigration. Thank you.
Well, welcome everybody. A little bit about the title, Religion and Public Life, The Journalist and the Theologian. So among the books of recommended reading from me is something called The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm. And so I love this book. It's a meditation on the ethics of journalism, the ethics of storytelling, and the ethics of nonfiction storytelling. So I thought I would do a little riff on that title and call this The Journalist and the Theologian. I also decided to call it that because it's a little bit of a riff on me, who, you know, went off to college thinking I was going to work in public radio, and then kind of fell in with this difficult crowd in the religion department and ended up accidentally going to divinity school. So even though I worked in public radio through high school and college and grad school, I ended up majoring in religion and getting an MDiv at the University of Chicago quite by accident. But in the third quarter of my three horrendously miserable years at the University of Chicago, which I will tell you about over a drink sometime if you'd like, I cross-registered for a class at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. It was a class called Covering Religion and Spirituality. And everything that I had hoped graduate school would be ended up happening in this one course that, you know, sort of showed up as a pass-fail in my transcripts here on the other side of Chicago, because the two professors, who've actually since died, took me under their wings and said, so few people want to do this. We need people who care about both journalism and religion to do this. We will help you. We will mentor you. We will help you find jobs. And they really did. So I think journalist and the theologian, not journalist or the theologian, is a way that I think of what I do. And I'm probably a little too journalistic for most theologians, and I know that I'm way too theological for most journalists. I edit Tom Gelton, among others, at NPR. And he is, you know, a good Lutheran boy from Iowa who went to Concordia Moorhead and hated it and dropped out and then went to the U, and then has been working at NPR ever since he finished at the University of Minnesota. And he always says to me, you know way too much about religion to edit religion. But we're a really good team because he doesn't know a lot about religion, but he's the religion correspondent, so we work together as a team. So in thinking about this theme, I'm going to spend the first few minutes sort of on the theme for the whole week, and then I'm going to delve into the specific topic of religion and immigration. So lest you think that I am that I've originated this idea of the journalist and the theologian, Karl Barth, back when theologians showed up on the cover of Time magazine, by the way, the most recent one to show up on the cover of Time magazine was about 15 or 20 years ago, and it was Rick Warren. How we have fallen. So this is from April 20, 1962 issue of Time magazine, and this is the writer writing. This is not Barth speaking, but Karl Barth recalls that 40 years ago, 1923, he advised young theologians to take your Bible and your newspaper and read both, but interpret newspapers through the Bible. Newspapers, he says, are so important that I always pray for the sick, the poor, journalists, authorities of the state, and the church in that order. Journalists form public opinion. They hold terribly important positions. Now, I'm not trying to baptize my work with the words of Karl Barth here, but I do think that in a moment in our national history when charges of fake news are happening constantly and people trust less and less what is real or the truth, I think that it's important to remember that some of us are trying very, very hard to bring facts and truth to an audience, and that even though not my specific organization, because I don't think the person who uses the phrase fake news the most knows what my organization is. Obama was a member at WBEZ, though, I can tell you that. Because I worked at WBEZ and I looked at the membership rolls. So here's a little bit of the rationale for this week and some questions that I'd like you to think about and that I'm going to ask you to come back to maybe later tonight, and definitely later in the week. The intersection of religion and public life is at the heart of many conflicts in American life, from immigration to race relations to LGBTQ issues. And those are the three sessions we're going to do tonight: immigration, tomorrow race relations, and Friday LGBTQ issues. And these sessions are going to examine some news coverage around that and some polling data, some actual hard facts we have about what people think about various issues, about these three issues. So these are questions for you to help you think, but they're also questions that I would like to hear your responses to, because as you know, I work in radio, and so 30 million people hear everything I write, but I don't know what they think about what I write, because I hate Twitter, and I put things on Twitter, but I never read the comments, because when you have 30 million people, you cannot possibly care what everybody thinks. So we have audience research that tries to help me understand what 30 million people are thinking. So what role should secular news organizations play in covering religion and belief? And what theological role does public discourse play in clarifying and shaping belief and practice? So I thought it would be helpful to have a little bit of the religious landscape at the intersection of religion and politics in the United States. So this is from Pew Research. This is a 2014 poll. These numbers have not changed a lot over the years, but since 2016, they have changed some, because people who used to feel comfortable identifying as Republicans over the last 2.5 years were finding they're not as comfortable identifying as Republicans anymore. But this is arranged from the most Republican religious group in America, the Mormons, at 70%, down to the least Republican, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. So let's see here. ELCA is 43% Republican, 47% Democrat, which I probably would have guessed, but look, like the mainline Protestants are, you know, sort of clustering here around the 50-50 mark. Does anybody see anything in this list that they think might be surprising? That they think is surprising? Jehovah's Witnesses, many don't participate or vote at all, so.
Seventh-day Adventists.
I'm sorry?
Seventh-day Adventists, I'm surprised.
Where are they on here?
Right below the Episcopal.
Okay. We're going to actually hear a story. I'm glad you brought that up. We're going to actually hear a story at the end of the week about Seventh-day Adventists and political participation.
I don't see Catholic.
They right there.
Okay.
37% Republican, 44% Democrat. So that's just helpful to understand a little bit of the political landscape of various denominations. And here is the large gap between chambers of Congress and the shares of any denomination. What they noticed is that the biggest gaps are between Presbyterians and Catholics. So, for instance, the House has 53% Baptist, the Senate is 63% Baptist, and the U.S. is 48% Baptist. So,
I'm sorry, Protestant.
And that has changed dramatically over the years. The Congress, about in the 60s, was about was predominantly, incredibly predominantly Protestant, and then has become more and more and more Catholic. So right now, the largest group in Congress is Catholics. So again, here's a little bit of theological justification for why I think we should think about the intersection of religion and public life. I have a lot of sort of mid-century white males today, but they get less white as the week goes on, and we don't end with a white male as far as theologians go. Jürgen Moltmann, in Theology of Hope, writes that faith, wherever it develops into hope, causes not rest but unrest, not patience but impatience. It does not calm the unquiet heart, but it is itself the unquiet heart in humans. Those who hope in Christ can no longer put up with reality as it is, but begin to suffer under it, to contradict it. Peace with God means conflict with the world, for the goad of the promised future stabs inexorably into the flesh of every unfulfilled present. I think about this a lot from my own point of view as to why I participate in public life, but I also know that people who disagree with me and probably disagree with you politically also participate in public life. So this is something that I try to keep in mind. I don't exactly know what point of view Jürgen Moltmann was writing from about which kind of political activity that he was most interested in. This is not early Moltmann, this is sort of mid-late Moltmann. So. And here is an interesting, this poll was done by the Barna Group. Does anybody know what the Barna Group is?
Yeah.
So it's an evangelical polling sort of think tank. They're most famous, I think, for having coined the term notional Christian, which when they defined looked like everybody who wasn't a right-wing evangelical. So they don't really, I don't look at a lot of their data seriously because they basically don't believe that people like myself and probably many of you are Christians, even though we might call ourselves that. Because they have a very specific definition that involves like whether or not you're going to get into heaven, which is, I'm not very interested in the afterlife, so I think about it very little. So here, this is a poll of 530 Protestant clergy a couple of years ago, and the question was, to speak or not to speak, is it a major part of my role as a clergy member to help Christians have biblical beliefs about specific social issues? And 90% of the people who responded said yes. 72% said to help Christians think well about culture in general. How much influence do you feel you have with your congregation when it comes to how they think about current issues in society? And 60% said some, which that's probably what I would have thought. I'm a little surprised at how low this number is. And then how well equipped are you in your congregation for conversations about sensitive topics? Now this idea of sensitive topics is going to come back later this week. Just about half, a little over half, think that they are somewhat well equipped, but this is a very high percentage, I think, to say that they are not well equipped to talk about sensitive subjects. And later this week when I show you what their research showed about what are the topics that they do and do not feel comfortable talking about because they will get yelled at from their parishioners of talking about it, I think you'll be surprised as well. So that's a little bit of the landscape of the interaction of religion and public life, religion and politics, from Pew Research, which is, I think, sort of the gold standard for religion and public life research in America, and Barna, which asks some, I think, more ministerially focused questions than Pew ever would, because Pew is interested in helping journalists understand the world, and I think Barna is interested in helping pastors and theologians, specifically in the evangelical tradition, understand the world. So I want to move now into the topic of religion and immigration, and most of this is going to be you listening to pieces and responding to them, but I want to set enough of a groundwork so that we all are on the same page by the time we get there. This is an interesting question that Pew asked in 2012 and 2013. This was the height of the previous immigration debate under the Obama administration, and there was hope for some kind of national immigration reform, which ended up dying and not actually getting put through. But so the question put to the respondents was views of immigrants by religion, race, and ethnicity. So does religion strengthen, or is religion strengthening to America, a burden to America, neither or don't know? So the general public said that immigration, by 48%, that immigration strengthened America, but 39% said it was a burden to America. And then this is interesting to me, how many, in many instances, the churches are decidedly one or the other. I think this is the standout for me. Catholic and Hispanic Catholic, that the church, the country is strengthened by immigration.
Jason, I have a question.
Yes?
Under Protestants says white evangelical. I'm usually confused on podcasts and news reports with what is categorized as evangelical versus mainline. Yeah. Keep in mind that we are the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America.
Right.
And so
a terrible name.
And so what happens is people use that term evangelical in so many ways,
right,
from the president to the press and everybody. And I view myself as an evangelical in the sense that I want to spread God's love and God's good news and so on. But yet, I don't think I'm really an evangelical as some newscasters or politicians
right.
say that I am.
Well, if, so generally the mainline Protestant denominations are ELCA, Presbyterian, UCC, Episcopalian, Methodist. Methodists are very interesting, and there's a lot of interesting work going on with Methodists right now about what they will become, because they just made a decision that will cause a break that will make the global Methodist Church evangelical, and the U.S. Methodist Church, which is likely to break away and become its own thing, will become mainline Protestant, decidedly mainline Protestant. Somebody else have a question?
It's just, it doesn't look like all the data is right. It's white evangelical 51%, and 30%, and is 85%, and that plus 9% only adds up to 93%. So why does that add up to
it? It explains that figures may not round, may not add to 100% due to rounding errors. So that's Pew's explanation of this, of these numbers. Generally, in America, when we answer the who's an evangelical, Southern Baptists often fall into that category. Actually, we can move back here, and I can. Southern Baptists, which I think here are listed as Baptists. Pentecostal would probably be included with evangelicals. Reconstructionists probably, Adventists. Holiness would be, I think from this list, that's probably it.
Just as I think about NPR, it'd be nice if, you know, like, because a lot of times they say the evangelicals are those Christian people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they confuse the words. Mm-hmm. And they say those Christian people are all Trump supporters,
right.
or they all think this way. And I don't think all Christians or all Lutherans think the same way.
Right, but I mean, white evangelicals supported Donald Trump at like very, very high percentages. White, well, conservative evangelicals, but white evangelicals versus white mainline Protestants supported Donald Trump. So when I'm editing a piece, I will often say conservative evangelicals because there are progressive evangelicals. Not a ton, but there are progressive evangelicals. So I try to just be as precise as possible and as descriptive as possible without using a lot of the code words. And I do think
They say white evangelical, but they don't say what white mainline Protestant Christians are. You see what I'm saying? They only talk about that one line and not the other.
There are very few mainline Protestants in America left. So we don't actually report on them very often. And
okay.
The main thing that mainline Protestants do is fight about gay clergy. That's what we learned for 20 years in America, right? So the first 10 years I covered religion, almost everything I did had to do with either Catholic clergy sex abuse or some mainline Protestant denomination fighting about gay clergy.
Yeah.
And I think that it wasn't that that wasn't an important conversation to have, but it seemed to be the only public thing that the Episcopal Church was doing around its gay bishop, and it seemed to be the only thing that the Lutheran Church was doing for several decades. I actually think that many of the mainline Protestant denominations have actually started to find their voice on issues now that they have kind of dealt decisively with LGBT issues, or almost decisively on many of those issues. I'm going to get to LGBT stuff on Friday. So let's think about, and then I'm going to get to playing pieces for you, which is the heart of what I'm here to do. So during the current presidential administration, denominations, congregations, and faith-based groups have become more active in speaking out publicly about their beliefs regarding immigration and refugees. And I would say that this is a place where many of the mainline Protestant denominations have actually found their voice in the last couple of years in ways that I was surprised at, because I'm so used to them not being able to come up with something to say because they're so worried about offending the last four people in the back row of any given congregation. So here are some questions to guide our thinking for the rest of this evening. In what ways are these voices being amplified through reporting? Are enough points of view being represented in reporting? And this is a question that I will have about everything. How could our coverage be better? How could not just NPR's coverage be better, but how would you like to see these issues being reported on? So Pew has also done some polling about immigration. This is so tiny on the screen, I can't see it, so I have to step over here to see it. Which comes closer to your view about how to handle undocumented immigrants? So, should be allowed to stay legally if they meet certain requirements. So 73% of people in this poll said that they should be allowed, and only 24% people said they shouldn't be allowed. I find that really interesting considering the current crisis that we're having in America, that if 74% of people agreed on anything, we would think it's a landslide.
Right.
So why is it that we can't actually have policy and legislation and signing of legislation? That's I can't think of anything that people agree on that much. And if you look group by group, Protestant 69%, white evangelical 64%, that's an interesting number. This is the group that supports the current administration. It's overwhelming that people want some kind of way for people in the country to be able to stay if they meet certain requirements. And how important is it that the President and Congress pass significant immigration legislation this year? Now this, I don't really understand how only 49% of the people say it's important, but 73% of the people say there should be a fix. It's a strange, I think it's a very strange disconnect. Mm.
So it's 2014.
Yes. So
do you think it's just drastically changed with the current administration?
I think of this as the context for what led to that election, right? Mm-hmm. So this is stuff going on 2012, 13, 14, that then led to the election. So I wonder if these numbers have changed significantly. I don't think they have. People want there to be some kind of solution. I just think that we happen to hear a small number of very loud voices. Maybe I'm playing my hand too much by saying that I think we only hear a small number of very loud voices. So part of what I like to do is, I don't really like reporting on polls, so this is the end of the polls for the afternoon. What I like to do is take these numbers, these facts, and enflesh them, to incarnate them into real people's stories out in congregations or out in groups. So the next few, the rest of our evening, we're going to spend listening to some pieces, and I want to hear your feedback after we listen to these pieces. So keep these questions in mind. In what ways are these voices being amplified through reporting, and are enough points of view being represented? So this piece aired about a year and a half ago, on All Things Considered.
That immigration debate in Congress this week is being followed closely by Christian leaders who say their churches could not survive without immigrant worshipers. And here's Tom Jelton as well.
Fair Meadows Baptist Church on the south side of Dallas, Texas, was on the verge a year ago of going out of business. As few as a dozen people were showing up each Sunday. But then a new group arrived and asked to rent the church for their own worship services. Their congregation is now thriving.
Father, we want to serve you. Use us as instruments, Father, to honor you and glorify you, Father. And as we pray, Father.
Each Wednesday night, several of the people who founded the new congregation gather at the church to pray together. Elia Arriaga is among them. All are Hispanic, immigrants, or the children of immigrants. When they pray, they go back and forth between English and Spanish.
En ti hay paz, en ti hay libertad.
Pastor Rolando Rodriguez organized the congregation, which now has about 30 families. This is what's called a church plant, a congregation organized from scratch. Church planting is a Rodriguez specialty. He has started more than a dozen in the last 20 years. He now coordinates Hispanic ministries for the whole Texas Baptist Convention.
The convention is not asking me, well, you have to plant churches. I mean, I do it because that's my calling.
Rodriguez says it takes him about 6 months to get a new congregation up and running. He follows a step-by-step process.
Number one, to find my core group, 2-3 families, to train, to find a place, to raise some money, because a church plant, you need funding, you need resources.
This is how faith spreads. New churches get established, and then they grow. And in America, it's immigrants, Hispanic immigrants in particular, who are leading this movement. Across Texas, Rodriguez says, between a quarter and a third of new Baptist churches have been founded by Hispanic immigrants.
When they come and when they see that somebody is lending a hand when they need it the most, you know, they become very receptive to the gospel. And it's a great opportunity for us to not just tell them about Christ, but show them.
The phenomenon is evident across Christian denominations. If you Pew Research Center says about 40% of Eastern Orthodox Christians in the U.S. are immigrants, as are one-fourth of all U.S. Catholics. Bishop Michael Olson leads the Diocese of Fort Worth, Texas.
In times of crisis, we become much more acutely aware of our needs. And immigration is a time of crisis coming to a new nation. It is very important and critical that people find safety and something familiar so they can encounter God and their neighbor.
But if immigrants need churches, it's also true that churches need immigrants at a time when church affiliation among the U.S.-born population is declining. Thus, the alarm among Christian leaders over the absence of an agreement to protect those immigrants known as Dreamers. And then there's the Trump administration plan to return as many as 300,000 immigrants who have fled violence or disaster and step up deportation efforts in general.
Mass deportation of current immigrants in America will do nothing less than cripple American Christianity for generations to come, and arguably in a definitive manner.
Samuel Rodriguez is president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference. When you deport immigrants, he says, you are deporting the future of American Christianity.
This is the fastest growing element of American Christianity. Across the board, Catholicism, evangelicalism, mainline denominations, if you're a follower of Christ, then you would want to embrace the immigrants.
Rodriguez is one of about 100 Christian leaders who last week signed a full-page ad in the Washington Post advocating a generous immigration policy. They cited the biblical instruction to love one's neighbor. But their concern is also existential. Without immigrants, they fear, the U.S. church as we know it may not survive. Tom Jelton, NPR News.
So I wanted to do this piece because I knew about these numbers, but I wanted to meet the people who were trying to do these, you know, trying to create these churches. And I also wanted to have many people of faith from many different points of, well, not necessarily points of view, but many different denominations, so Orthodox, Baptist, Catholic, all talking about how crucial this is for the church in America. But I also got a little bit of criticism that I did not have anti-immigrant Christians in the story. The problem is, I sent Tom looking for them, and they couldn't make a decent point. So I really want people to not just sort of recite talking points to me or my reporters. So, and I don't actually think that it is in the interest of balance to put people not making any sense on the radio. So I think that, well, a lot of people in my own company disagree with me. But I wanted to have, I don't necessarily think this piece has to be a controversial piece about Christians disagreeing with each other about immigration policy. It can be based on some hard facts that, like, the only growth in many of these denominations is among Spanish-speaking immigrants. And so there should be some kind of policy to address and welcome these immigrants into the country. So coming back to my questions from earlier, what voices were amplified in this story? And I've already told you I think is missing, but missing perhaps with cause.
It seems like the only immigrant group that was focused on were Latinos.
Yes. It's because I sent him to Texas to report on Latino immigrants. I think that the more specific you can be in a piece of journalism, the better. And so we're not trying to cover all immigrants. We're specifically Hispanic immigrants. And he went to Texas to do this reporting. So the real people, as we call them in the stories, the pastor, the person who works with the Baptist Commission in the area, or the Hispanic churches in the area, and the Catholic bishop in, I think it was Fort Worth, they were specifically talking, and we were asking them specifically about Latino immigrants.
So what does the research show about other immigrant groups and their contribution to the American church?
Hispanic immigrants are where the growth in the church is coming from. There is some growth among Asian immigrants, but it's nowhere near the size. I think Filipino immigrants are, especially in California, a very large area of growth as well. So that would be something else to focus on. I should say that one of the things that we do, we are not the We don't cover everything all the time, so this, we've specifically decided to focus on Latino immigrants for this story. I know this because I have edited stories about Asian immigrants, especially Korean immigrants. And in fact, I'm working on a story right now about Korean immigrants in Los Angeles who are, through their church, opposing a homeless shelter in the neighborhood of the church. But the church does homeless outreach, like they want homeless people to come to their church, they just don't want them to live around them.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah, if it were done, I would have brought it with me, but it's like one third of the way reported right now.
So it would have been interesting to hear an evangelical kind of against immigration confronted with these facts that they could speak intelligently about it. So maybe you did that when they could.
We're going to hear in the third piece a little bit about that.
Okay.
I was surprised by something that I heard Franklin Graham say about refugees.
Yes. I think possibly the issue between maybe the evangelical or mainline might be the process of coming in the country. Like if you're legally here, or are these churches, you know, like when my ancestors came, they had to go through a process to be here. They navigated towards German, you know, communities, and they helped them, they assisted them. They didn't depend on, like, the government to do everything. It was the churches that gave out the housing and gave the food and stuff like that. And I think in some ways we say, come here, but then you can meet your spiritual needs, but you also need to say, yes, we're going to help you with this, we're going to help you to come in, this is a process you go through. I think that might be a difference between, it's the processing of the immigrants, not to just come here free everything and do it no matter what, but I, you know, like our relatives had to come through Ellis Island. They sat there in these probably worse conditions than maybe our, I don't know.
No one was in a cage at Ellis Island.
But I mean, they came through there. They had to do, if they were sick, they were sent back.
So the vast majority.
It's like the processing of.
So the vast majority.
The churches helped out, and they had a sponsor. They had people here to help them.
Right. The vast majority of people who are currently in the country illegally came into the country legally and overstayed a visa. So they were in the process. The problem is that process is extreme. When people say, like, get in line or get in the right line, there are about 3 dozen lines to be in. And sometimes you have to be in 2 lines at once. And when you step out of this line to be in that line, you lose your place in that line. So the whole process is problematic. Well, it's that there isn't a clear path.
Yeah.
There are multiple paths that end up looking like a plate of spaghetti rather than lines.
Yeah, but still, that part, yes, has to be worked out. But you need to, it's like going in and out of our country now. I mean, I've gone to Canada, we had to stand in these lines for hours just to go through passport stuff and whatever. I mean, you just got to do what you got to do, but to protect your country, basically, so you don't have.
The difference is you're white.
It might be important to point out, too, that the first law about immigration, the first laws were to keep Chinese people out of this country. Before that, there were no processes. There was no legislation. It was the first thing we did as a country is to keep Chinese people out.
A couple of questions that I want to move on to another story about refugees.
Criticism of the story. I was very interested in the comment about planting churches.
Mm-hmm.
And you said it needs financing, and then nothing further about that. I was disappointed to not hear even just a couple of more snippets about how he was able to do that.
I was able to. Yeah, other Baptist churches in the area help finance them. What's interesting to me, the most interesting thing to me about that, anybody here who thinks that you can plant a church in 6 months, that sounds crazy to me. But maybe they're not thinking about churches that last 100, congregations that last 100 years. Maybe they think it's successful if it lasts a couple of years and then shuts down or merges with another. I think somebody over here had a question, and you, and then I'm going to move on. Yes?
Another angle to maybe go to a different layer with this is what churches are reaching out to immigrant communities and actively trying to bring them in versus not. I'd like to see the numbers. I've seen them recently about the decline of mainline churches and the explosion of churches that have decided to let people of color, you know, immigrant communities into them. The Quakers have a book out called Good Enough for Freedom, but Not for Friendship. They supported freeing blacks, but they didn't welcome them into the congregation because somehow that didn't work. I don't know how the Lutherans stand on that these days, but that...
They say they want a more diverse church, but it's gotten whiter over the last...
Right, so that could have been a good community maybe to go to and say, your numbers are shrinking, you're predominantly white, what's your discussion about this?
I think that feels to me as an editor like a separate story.
Yeah.
When you have 3 to 5 minutes to tell any story, in part, just understand that this airs on All Things Considered, and there are 20 or so stories every night on All Things Considered that have to cover a lot of stuff. And so I think of these 3 to 5 minute pieces as like, here's a topic that we think is interesting enough for you to think more about. It is called All Things Considered and not A Few Things Considered in excruciating detail. So, although I think sometimes when I hear some of our stories, it feels like A Few Things Considered in excruciating detail. One more point, and then I want to move on to.
So that we're members at Central Lutheran Church in Minneapolis, and they're celebrating their 100th anniversary as the first English-speaking church in the Minneapolis area. And I have often pondered how much that, both the language and the cultural assimilation that is offered by, you know, the Spanish. It said in your piece, they pray in Spanish and in English.
And they move back and forth.
Yeah. And how much does that play a part in their affinity towards this particular group? And you know, maybe we ought to pay more attention to the fact that, you know, if you're Hispanic and I know a pastor's wife who, Lutheran pastor's wife who has trouble with English. And she's, I'm sure, is very uncomfortable being in a regular English service. And how much do we take that into account? You know, the fact that when you first come here, you don't necessarily feel comfortable in that language or in that culture. And it's one thing to embrace the culture and ask everybody to come in, and it's another thing to reach out to the culture and give them what they need.
Right. I mean, my somewhat biased take on the problem in the ELCA is that it says, come to us and you'll get whiter.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, my own congregation, which I love, like, has a real problem with anything that isn't like 18th century German hymnody. So, or we only do it on Pentecost because then it's, you know. And people refer to things like the impossible Japanese hymn. Like, you know, people, that there is a consequence to making those jokes.
Yeah.
So I want to move immigration. I should call this immigration and refugee issues, because the next piece that I want to play for you is about, this was sort of just after the inauguration, and there was a lot of talk of sending out people who were currently here as refugees, and a lot of talk of not welcoming in more refugees. And I'm going to play, the third piece I'm going to play for you is a piece about that. But I thought it would be interesting to go to some congregations, one that was preparing for, to offer asylum to refugees, you know, basically opening their churches, and to one that had done it many years ago, the last time we were thinking about people taking asylum in churches in the 80s. So I assigned Gabriel Emanuel in Boston to tell me the story of some people getting ready to offer asylum, and some people who had offered asylum in the past.
Some religious communities are sheltering or preparing to shelter people at risk of deportation as the Trump administration cracks down on unauthorized immigration. From member station WGBH in Boston, Gabriela Emanuel has more.
On a narrow side street in Cambridge, Massachusetts, music spills out of University Lutheran Church. Inside the front door are rainbow Adirondack chairs. And if you head up the back stairs, you'll see a room where there will soon be
a trundle bed.
That's Pastor Carrie Jo Verhulst. Her church is converting Sunday school classrooms to living quarters with the help of a diverse group of nearby Christian and Jewish congregations.
This is bedding. So lots and lots of bedding and towels.
With a half dozen air mattresses and a futon lined up, the church is getting ready to host undocumented immigrants who fear deportation. In Denver, a congregation is already hosting an undocumented person avoiding immigration enforcement. And in Los Angeles, the Episcopal Church there has declared itself a sanctuary diocese. U.S. immigration officials have a policy of staying away from what are called sensitive locations, places like schools, hospitals, and houses of worship. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesperson says this policy remains in effect under the new administration. Pastor Verhulst hopes it holds, but she says another, older policy comes to mind.
Okay, so this is the Book of Numbers.
Pulling out her Bible, she flips to the Old Testament.
You shall designate three cities beyond the Jordan and three cities in the land of Canaan to be cities of refuge. These six cities shall serve as a refuge for the Israelites.
In these cities, people were beyond the reach of law enforcement. And it wasn't just the Israelites. In ancient Egypt, Rome, and Greece, temples were sanctuaries.
It's a fairly natural progression for Christian churches to claim the same ability to protect fugitives that others had.
Carl Shoemaker is a professor at the University of Wisconsin and an expert in the history of sanctuary law. He says for centuries, congregations have provided for those on the run. In America, churches were key stations on the Underground Railroad. And more recently, in the 1980s, a network of churches helped people flee wars in Central America.
These churches are certainly situating themselves within a very long 2,000-year-old tradition.
Just a few blocks from University Lutheran is the Old Cambridge Baptist Church. It too has a history of sheltering people, people like Magdalena Rivas.
Here in my bedroom, I decide.
In 1984, Rivas escaped El Salvador's bloody civil war. She was undocumented, so congregants here took turns staying with her. Beneath big blue stained glass windows, they kept watch for immigration authorities. Rivas says one place in the church was particularly soothing.
You see what that?
She peers into the baptismal basin where she used to bathe.
And you feel it's safe.
It was safe in there.
Yeah, I always, but you know, you're relaxing, you go feeling Jesus, yours.
It was there, submerged in the waters of the baptistry, that she felt the safest. Magdalena Rivas eventually received political asylum and citizenship. She says she feels lucky and glad that there were houses of worship to shelter her then and so many others today. For NPR News, I'm Gabriella Emanuel.
So one of the reasons I wanted to play this piece is that, especially with Magdalena at the end, I think that it's easy for us to say, follow the rules and you can come into the country. But when you're fleeing war, and not just with actual declared war, but if you're fleeing grinding poverty or you're fleeing domestic violence, there are many things that you could be fleeing that are going to prevent you from following the appropriate rules, mm-hmm. and that there should still be a way to seek refugee status and asylum. And so failing the government's ability to do that, these churches were trying to do that. What are some of the voices or images from that piece that stick with you?
Just wonderful ending of her finding sanctuary within the sanctuary, right? In the baptismal tub. And it made me think about, I think I'm correct in thinking Jesus baptized in the Jordan, which was on a boundary, on a border, right? So anyways, all those things came together.
Yeah, that was actually the first, the reporter called me to tell me that she wanted to just do that story. Mm-hmm. And I said, I want that story, but I think you need to connect that whole, that 30-some-year-old story to the present. Mm-hmm. So I asked her to find, and it just so happened that there was a congregation a few blocks away.
Yeah. And I think it makes it powerful having those two stories of, mm-hmm. here's someone who came 30 years ago, mm-hmm. and we don't know from the story, but we can imagine, well, what's her life like now? Mm-hmm. Because that, so then we can project forward, what if churches provide sanctuary now, what might happen?
Right, she was eventually granted asylum, asylee status. Mm-hmm. And we made a point of making that clear in the story, that she doesn't still live in that church 35 years later. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting how several Christian communities and non-Christian communities came together to support the immigrants. Mm-hmm. And so the Jewish community, that it wasn't just one church or one denomination, but a spiritual community all came together.
Right.
Yeah,
I try to, when reporters pitch me stories like this, I often say, where else is this happening? I'm going to ground the story in one specific place, but if there are other examples, there are many more examples than the three she gives. I think she mentions Denver, Los Angeles, and someplace else. I don't remember the third place. But I try to just say, sort of show that this is one example of many stories that we could have told. Other thoughts? Reflections on the voices you hear?
I appreciated the historical context.
Ah, yes, the public radio movement going to a professor. Yeah. We always say, but who's the expert? I like to push the reporter to find the actual person who knows, not just who's ever teaching history at the local university, but this person is actually the expert on asylum law in America.
Yeah.
Church asylum law.
But we're so short-sighted that we think, sanctuary cities, this is a problem of 2000 and whatever.
Right.
Not that this has been a historical...
For millennia, right. This is a move of mine, and you're going to hear this in the third piece, to actually get the people who say, I'm doing this because the Bible tells me to do it. I want them to show me where. And so I actually asked the reporter to go back and get the pastor, showing her where these sanctuary cities were. Mm-hmm. And usually people know, but sometimes we just let people get away with saying, well, it's our tradition, so we do it, rather than, well, what is the basis for that tradition? Other thoughts or questions about this piece?
Did NPR get any feedback, negative feedback for running this piece?
Not that I know of. Usually, as I said, I don't spend time on Twitter, but if people write in to complain about things, there are means by which I hear about it, usually the ombudsman, and our standards and practices editor, but mostly the ombudsman, and I did not get any response from this. Mostly the response is the voice that somebody specifically wanted to hear they didn't hear in the piece, mm-hmm. to which a really good response is, it's a 3 minute and 40 second piece, mm-hmm. or a 3 minute and 49 second piece, not everybody can be in there. And especially around immigration, we probably have, half a dozen immigration pieces a day on our own these days, so we can't put everything in every one piece.
Is that accurate, what that she was saying, in terms of there is a policy that ICE will not go after churches who claim that? Because we hear a lot about going after cities and so on, but is that still kind of don't go there?
As of March 14th, 2017, that was the policy, because I had her check the day before this aired, or probably the morning that this aired, just to make sure that they were still standing by that policy. But I know of instances where ICE has broken their own rule. I wouldn't say they didn't break their own rule. They stretched the rule beyond recognition. So there's a church in Rochester that has, it's a Catholic congregation. I've done a story about this. I'm sorry, I didn't bring it. It's impossible to download here, otherwise I'd play it for you. But it's a Catholic congregation that has Sunday afternoon an all-Spanish mass, as many Catholic congregations do. And ICE, in a marked vehicle, parks in front of the church. Now, it doesn't go into the church, but it's designed to scare people from going to church and make them live with a lot of anxiety. And it is not illegal for them to park their vehicle in front of a church, but it seems like a really heavy-handed scare tactic to me.
But there's no recorded instances of them going into a sanctuary and dragging somebody out.
Not that I know of. But as I said, the rules are being stretched or bent in many ways. So it also used to be courthouses were also once considered safe places. So that if you had to go in, say you went in because you had a court case around domestic violence, well, they used to not put immigration cops outside those courtrooms, but now they do in Portland. I've edited pieces out of Portland where they're stationing ICE officials around courtrooms where there are Spanish interpreters because they think that there will be undocumented people going in and out of those courtrooms.
So that's an opportunity for us then, isn't it?
To hang out in courthouses?
For churches. I mean, for churches, just to really claim we know the people are in our neighborhood, and we know who they are, who are undocumented, but just to say, you're here, and you've got sanctuary in this place, but does that mean they once they step outside the doors, then they're free to...
Okay. Yeah, I had another piece that I'm not playing for you, but it was a Unitarian congregation in... just outside Aspen, I don't remember what, there's an even smaller city than Aspen, outside of Aspen, where the Unitarian Church had a undocumented immigrant living there, and the police would knock on the door regularly. And if they opened, but this was complicated because the person was in the parsonage, and whether the parsonage is part of the church as a whole, as many of you who get parsonage probably. That was an interesting story because part of the congregation was very like, well, if she were in the basement of the church, it'd be one thing, but she's living with the pastor in the spare bedroom in the parsonage now. So, okay. But ICE did knock on those doors because they were confused, I think, about like what the parsonage was, and it wasn't like attached to the church, it's the house next to the church like many parsonages are. I want to play one more piece for you before we close the evening. So, earlier, I mentioned that I think that many mainline Protestant denominations have figured out how to find their voice on the issue of immigration and refugees. And this piece, as I mentioned earlier, I love to get like what's the biblical justification for this, or what's the theological justification for the thing that you're doing. This was a weird situation where I assigned Tom Jelton to give the biblical justification for taking care of immigrants and refugees. Luckily, I think it's the UCC put out this huge list of Bible verses that had to do with immigration, and so I just thought, well, let's just do a story that looks at which denominations are doing that and which ones aren't. This whole story started because of the quote that we hear at the end from Franklin Graham, because I heard him say this, and I said, oh my God, that's not true. So we reported a story, and this is part of the job of journalists is to fact check, and you know, is to report on what's true, not just what people say. Yes. So I'll play this piece for you. I bet you can tell which thing I thought was outrageous.
Most of the refugees arriving in the United States are resettled here by faith-based organizations. These groups see this work as a kind of ministry. And as NPR's Tom Jelton reports, they are not happy with President Trump's plan to suspend the refugee programs.
In Judeo-Christian scripture, God's commandments on the treatment of foreigners and strangers could hardly be more clear. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament to Christians, the Israelites are reminded they were themselves aliens once in the land of Egypt. From the book of Leviticus, the alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you. You should love the alien as yourself. That guidance continues in the New Testament. In the book of Matthew, Jesus tells his followers, I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Linda Hartke is president of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, which over the years has resettled 500,000 refugees and migrants here.
It is deeply ingrained in our faith and our understanding of the Bible that we're called to welcome the stranger, to love and serve our neighbors, not the neighbors that we choose, but the neighbors that God gives to us.
Whether Christian or not, the idea of prioritizing Christian refugees, as President Trump plans to do, does not come from her church or from most other Christian groups, for that matter. Hartke says, since word leaked that Trump wants, at least temporarily, to close America's doors to refugees, her phone has been ringing off the hook.
Those are hard calls to take, to have to tell people that the president's decisions will likely mean that there won't be refugees that they can be welcoming in the months and perhaps years ahead.
The faith groups active in refugee resettlement have been, in Hartke's words, strategizing in recent days over how to respond to the president's executive order. Sean Callahan, president of Catholic Relief Services, thinks they need to make more clear to Americans that the refugees have been carefully screened.
We have found that the refugees who have come to the United States have been thoroughly vetted and that they have been placed in homes and actually it's been an enriching experience as opposed to a threat.
How much resistance to President Trump's refugee ban might we expect? Here's Mark Hetfield, president of the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society.
The faith groups are going to kick and scream and object at every aspect of this disgusting, vile executive order, which makes America out to be something that it is not. You know, we are a country that welcomes refugees.
Though, as Hetfield points out, there have been interruptions in that history, as when Jews fleeing Nazi Germany were turned away.
Those are periods that we now look back upon with horror and shame. And what is particularly offensive to me, leading a Jewish refugee organization, is that he signed these executive orders on International Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Many evangelical Christians are in town this week for what they're calling the March for Life rally, making known their opposition to abortion. The majority of evangelicals voted for Trump in part because of his promise to appoint judges who will take a strong stand on abortion. But many say their broader concern is human dignity. While there's more sympathy among these evangelicals for Trump's decision to halt the refugee flow, it's not absolute. Jim Daly is president of the Focus on the Family.
If it's a temporary pause to create a screening process that helps find people that are trying to get in to do harm to this country, I understand that. But I would also support a robust program to reestablish immigration, because that's what this country is built upon, and it's a great Christian tradition to bring people in who are hurting.
Within the evangelical world, there are dissenting voices. Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, told the Huffington Post this week that the refugee question, in his view, is not a Bible issue. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
The one thing I think I would do differently in that piece, the guy from Catholic Refugee Services actually explains it. The problem is it's a bad cell phone connection because we turned this piece in like 3 hours. Refugees are the most screened people who get into this country. Like, they're quite often living in refugee camps for years or decades, and they have had a screening like we would not imagine to get into this country. So to let the guy from Focus on the Family say, well, as long as they're making, maybe they're pausing it to make sure we're screening them well, that is kind of a ridiculous thing, and I probably would have rearranged the tape to have him say that and then have the response from Catholic Refugee Services that says it's actually the most screened group of people who come into America.
One of the frustrations I have in this report and the organization I work for, with a long history of working with refugees, is the policy around it and how it actually works is not well understood, and I don't know that journalism, because it's kind of detailed and a little bit complicated, we don't get that. For example, the president decides the number of refugees that come in, and it's no surprise that Trump has basically turned the spigot off, so there he can set the number of whatever he wants every year. So Obama was doing about 100,000 a year. Trump immediately put it at 50. And the trouble with that, and this is another thing that's happened across the nation, there's infrastructure at Lutheran Social Service in Minnesota to handle the 100,000 that Obama was sending through. And if they get cut in half, you've got a staff. And many times, Lutheran Social Services have sort of bet the farm on this, and they've got 60% of their business.
Right.
And now it's, so some of this is not getting reported.
Right. No, I was actually going to say, we've done stories about how many of these, six of the seven refugee resettlement organizations are faith-based, and all of them have laid off tremendous numbers of staff. I don't know what the numbers are for LEARS, Lutheran Immigration Refugee Services, but I imagine it is similar. One little personal note on this story. I have, for as long as I've had money to give, I've given a little bit of money to Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, and as soon as he put them in a piece, I had to stop giving to them. So now I launder the money through my congregation, which is a great way to launder money. So it counts for my benevolence or something like that. It makes it more easily tax deductible because I only have to think about it. I want to be respectful of time, but if there were maybe one or two other questions that or comments that people had from these pieces.
Have you got any story on, I think it's called Amparo, the program that the ELCA has to accompany the minors as they go through the process of the courts when they're here undocumented?
I have not personally edited those stories, but we have a whole separate immigration team that may have. I don't know precisely if we have. I don't think so. I don't recall them.
I want to go back to Moltmann and how you started out the whole evening. The troubling aspect of what hope actually does. And I just kind of want to lay that before us all again as something that from a deep core of what the gospel is all about, we've got to really help our kids, our teenagers, our young adults really come to grips with what that means, because the times are not getting any easier. And with climate change and mass migration and all this sort of stuff, we've got to really come up with understanding what does hope mean and therefore require, and how does that come out of who we have been throughout our whole story, our scriptural story. And I like how you say, where in the scripture? I mean, hold us all accountable to that.
If people are going to say the Bible says, they should be able to say something more than that.
Yeah.
Just to give you a sense of this quote, not this picture, but this quote hangs above my desk at work. The denunciation of injustice implies the rejection of the use of Christianity to legitimize the established order. Gustavo Gutierrez, a liberation theology. So when I'm editing these stories of immigration, and this doesn't only just apply to immigration, but I have Gustavo right above my computer. A few of people come into my office, a very weird office, because I also collect religious kitsch. So I have flame-breathing nuns, and all the Luthers, and a solar pope. He's in a pope mobile, and when it's sunny, he wins. Yes?
Is a faith-based group considered the mosques and stuff, a place of refuge? That would concern me a little bit.
So when I say faith-based organization in a piece, what I mean is a separately incorporated, like for instance, these refugee resettlement organizations, separately incorporated nonprofits that do refugee resettlement. That's what I'm talking about.
Do mosques say that about themselves to the government because we can't discriminate against houses?
All houses of worship are covered under the same rule, which is not the 501c3 rule. It's a different rule that I can't remember the name of. They don't have to separately incorporate as 501c3s, but they function as nonprofits. I can't remember the rule. I'm sure somebody here probably knows.
Do you think they would be considered as houses of worship for protecting refugees?
I'm sure they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, that would be, to me, a legitimate concern.
Why?
Just because in the country came, with the 9/11 thing, they came in Canada, but I don't know if they went to the houses of worship, but somehow they were functioning here, and, they ended up, somebody sponsored them, gave them all that money to go to Ukraine and
So the shooters in Columbine were both members of Lutheran congregations. Should those Lutheran congregations not have status to protect people?
I'm saying that they had a large, I mean, it was like a particular, well, okay, I did not know they were Lutheran, I knew they were Americans, okay, I did not have any clue about that. But I'm just saying that just in general, there are, and they have said in their religion, you know, way back, you know, in the Middle East, whoever, that they hate America, down with America and all that stuff, and then, you know, just to come in, I mean, I'm near Detroit, I'm in Cleveland, but I also have relatives in Detroit, very big, you know, Muslim mosque areas. And they have seen money funnel through there for terrorists and they fought people for that. So I think there can be a concern about the sheltering of, but we can't discriminate anymore.
Well, I mean, I think all religious groups have radicals.
It's not a Christian group.
Well, all religious groups have radicals. Yeah, there are a lot of Christian radicals that scare the shit out of me.
Yeah.
And I think that it's incredibly unfair to suggest that just because an organization isn't Christian, it shouldn't have the same protection as a house of worship for offering sanctuary. I mean, the people who are in sanctuary in places like the churches in Boston are not known criminals. They overstayed a visa, or they fled into the, or they came into the country as an administrative violation, and they're being threatened with deportation back to a war zone. I would suggest that Syria is just as dangerous now, or Yemen is just as dangerous now as El Salvador was in the 80s.
But their particular religion promotes Sharia law, which is not Judeo-Christian necessarily. And our country was founded on Judeo-Christian values and not Sharia law.
Our country was founded to have a freedom of exercise and a disestablishment of religion.